This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Play the play on the show.
It is Danny and Gallant and the Seattle Seahawks. They're gonna make some draft picks later. I think we figured they're going to make more than the three that they currently have. And the difficulty of not having a first-round pick is it becomes even tougher than usual. And usually it's impossible to project who they're going to take. But it becomes even tougher because you're talking about, at earliest, they might be selecting 56th overall. So let's discuss how you approach this draft. How you approach it. Because you've got a quarterback who has 3 years left on his contract, who is now on the other side of 30, but just barely, and right still in his wheelhouse. Prime time should be, this should be the salad days of your tenure with a franchise quarterback, but there's been a little bit of friction. Do you approach this draft with the expectation that Russ is with you for the next 7-8 years and quarterback is not something you have to worry about? Or do you start, at the very least, possibly thinking with an eye toward contingency planning for an alternative future?
And we saw, what, a mock draft where a quarterback was on the table for the Seattle Seahawks at that 56th spot. Here is what I believe you always should do. If someone falls in the draft at quarterback that you like, you shouldn't say no. You shouldn't. And I would say that there are a lot of things that have been awesome when it comes to the Seahawks and Russell Wilson, specifically the attendance record. You never know when that's going to change. I don't expect it to change anytime soon, but to have that alternative option at quarterback, it's not the worst idea in the world for most teams. The tricky thing is, Danny, is that in this year, you have 3 draft picks. How do you add to yourself in the short term with the understanding that even if he doesn't have the ability to really force his way out of town next offseason, should there be a similar result in 2021, there will definitely be a lot more of the same friction that we have experienced over the last 6 weeks if things don't get better. I don't know if that affects the way that the Seahawks approach things, but I do think that they should perhaps take a view at the short term more so than the long term come draft.
I agree with you, Paul, when it comes to the question of if a quarterback falls to you, you should draft him. I don't believe they should do that this year. Because whether it would be the straw that broke the camel's back or whatever, if you take a quarterback with your first pick this year, I think it's going to break the relationship with Russell one way or the other. Whether it is 12 months from now, whether it is 3 years from now, I think that would probably break the relationship with your quarterback. And I don't think it's unsalvageable. I don't think that given everything that's happened, I don't think that it's something you can't work through. So in principle, I agree with you. In practice this year, I don't want to consider that. At the same time, it's hard to say that you should just draft business as usual with the idea that we've got our quarterback figured out for the next 7 years, because there's other things that go into that, right? And every decision Seattle has made this offseason has made it appear that they are completely set at quarterback, right? Trading for Gabe Jackson, the different contracts that they've renegotiated, everything they've done, every decision they've made is very much like for the past 3 or 4 years, which is our quarterback is totally that is the one thing we are not sweating. And in fact, that gives us room to be more aggressive.
Right. And I think being aggressive means that you don't draft the quarterback to motivate Russell Wilson, as I have joked. I think you'd be consistent with what you've done. And with all those trades that you laid out, there's Carlos Dunlap, there's Jamal Adams, there's Quandre Diggs, there was Jadeveon Clowney, there was, not successfully, Quinton Dunbar. You have gone after veterans with those draft picks that you have. I think the Seahawks, Danny, are probably going to trade that second-round pick and turn it into more picks, because it would probably be smart to go after multiple guys in the third round or something like that to try to restock the roster. It's going to be difficult to do it this offseason. But I think if I'm in John Schneider's shoes, I don't know who is necessarily available that would be worth a second-round pick, but I'm thinking about using that second-round pick to acquire something that can help me out right now, more so than I am thinking about how I can get more draft picks out of said second-round pick.
I expect them to trade back. That's just what they always do.
Right.
But I totally get what you're saying, which is, hey, if anything, man, you should be willing to forsake all the draft picks to be able to move up, because the most important thing is you get a starter. I expect when you use a top three, one of the first three rounds, a pick 1 through 3, I expect to get a contributor. If you don't get a guy that gets on the field and becomes at some point a rank and file starter, I don't think you use that pick very well. Anything in the back half of the draft, I generally look at it as, hey, if that guy becomes someone who gets on the field consistently for you, that's a plus, that's an add. So in this case, they basically got one pick where you can expect them to get a solid contributor. And so I kind of see what you're saying, which is like, use that on the best guy you can get and don't take this more bites at the apple stuff.
The tricky thing is they have seemingly been really, really successful of late in that second round, where you look at Marquise Blair, who was expected to be a massive contributor last year, didn't really do a whole lot in 2019, but when he was on the field, he flashed. And, of course, DK Metcalf, who you got in the second round in 2019. But I don't know if that means that now all of a sudden it's just, you're just unlikely to find somebody in the second round that's going to be someone like that for you. And you go that back before that. I mean, it took until last year for Ethan Posick to give you anything. And Malik McDowell, of course, a second-round pick too. So it's not to say that all second-round picks are created equal, you know? You don't know what you're going to get in that spot. I do feel if there is someone available to them that they think can be an immediate contributor, that's a veteran on another team, and they would be willing to trade a second-round pick for it, that might be the smarter play than to go and acquire more draft picks, because I do think that you have to prioritize the short-term a little bit more than the long-term.
Here's the one thing about this draft in particular, is we've talked about how Seattle's situation is unique. This draft is unique. You know less about the players available in this draft than any draft the past 20, 25 years, right?
Yeah.
Like the travel restrictions when it comes to scouting, the fact that some of these guys have played, all of them have played fewer games and less out of conference, but some of them haven't played any game. You know less about this group of players than in any years past. And that most people would tell you in gambling, sort of, the unknown would create less distinction. The difference between a third and a first round pick might be less severe this year than it is in normal years, just because you have less information. Everybody's going to be flying in the dark a little bit. And in that regard, maybe it is that a fifth round pick this year isn't quite the same as a fifth round pick 2 years ago, because this year's fifth round picks, there might be some guy in there that would have played his way into the second or first round. He just never got the opportunity this year. He didn't get on the field. He didn't have the true pro day. There wasn't a combine, like all of those different things, which makes it less important. I do think that that might be one of the reasons why Seattle was willing to trade its first round pick this year. Maybe more willing to include that a first and a third round pick, where they're like, well, it is a draft where that's going to be less valuable than your normal draft.
Yeah. And I mean, shoot, you're seeing some of these 1AA players playing now. You know, that's been strange seeing the Jackson State Southern game, I think it was, or was, I forget what game it was on TV, but I'm watching once and I'm like, wait a second, is this a replay of college football? Oh no, it's an actual college football game that's taking place in the middle of March. April, this is weird. I don't know what's going on here. So, yeah, those smaller school guys, like someone along the lines of Trey Lance, but maybe not Trey Lance himself, at a North Dakota State or another 1AA program. Yeah, and you said it yesterday that the Seahawks, they are not afraid of those small school guys. And
yeah, I kind of like the fact that they're willing to take a flyer and take a chance on them. Man, I expect they're going to use it on an interior lineman. Like, if I had to guess, that's usually about the spot where tackles and top tier tackles go so much earlier. And that late first round, second or third round is where you tend, and Seattle has tended to find interior linemen, someone like Damian Lewis last year. Adding another receiver, if you were able to get another receiver and someone that you like, because you certainly got a clear opportunity at spot number three right now, right? Like that's a huge opening. And if you draft a receiver there, it's not so much putting all your eggs in one basket. I do find myself torn between that idea, though, of do you want an impact player, like someone who is faster, plays on the outside? Do you want an impact player like a receiver, like a pass rusher that you take a shot on because you're not sure what Daryl Taylor's going to provide and you hope Alton Robinson develops? Or do you go with a guy an interior lineman, which you need and probably has a higher floor. You're probably more certain that he's going to be a viable player, but the upside isn't there the same way it is at some of those other positions.
Do you think they will draft a need there, though? I mean, don't you feel that they would draft perhaps best player available in that?
What's their top need? What's their top need? Is it center? From a roster standpoint, you have right now, I think you've got your offensive line set with the exception of center. You've got your number three receiver. You've got a starting cornerback.
Well, that's what's tricky. It's what needs short term do you prioritize over a long term need? Because I would just say their biggest need probably right now is that they need to have a tackle of the future. I think you don't know how much longer Dwayne Brown has left. And the problem is, in the second round, you're probably not going to find the guy. You know, you're unlikely to find a high impact tackle in the second round, unless that guy just ends up falling off everyone's boards for reasons unbeknownst to us. In the short term, wide receiver three is definitely up there. Interior offensive lineman, do you really expect to find somebody that's going to be able to contribute right away when you just got Damian Lewis last year? Maybe that does make you a little more bullish about the idea, but I kind of think, Danny, that the offensive line, the starting offensive line, is set in stone.
I still think you got a question at center, but your point's well taken. Can you count on getting a starting center in the second round? No. No, you cannot. It is Danny and Gallant. We're going to have a lot of fun today before we wish Paul bon voyage for several days. Brock Heward's going to be with us for Blue 42. The Professor John Clayton in our morning drive. But right now, we got to check the presses. It's front page news.
This is the front page. Today's top two stories and why they matter. Every morning at 7:10. Get what you need to know to start your day right now.
Old man-esque column. It's not that I'm mad the Seahawks were unable to sign Giovanni Bernard, a player they were supposedly interested in. The Bucks were the ones who were able to sign him. I'm, Danny, annoyed by the principal of the Buccaneers who keep out-recruiting the Seahawks. Whether it's Antonio Brown last year, it's Giovanni Bernard this offseason. This is annoying to me that Tom Brady and Bruce Arians have been better draws than Russell Wilson and Pete Carroll.
I would have not thought twice about Giovanni Bernard going somewhere else until I saw, was it Jenna Lane said that the Seahawks were interested in
him?
And I was like, oh, but come on, you don't want something because someone else wants it.
Yes, I do. I want what I can't have, and I know that I want what I can't have, and I want what I can't have because the Bucks got him. And now I'm starting to get annoyed by the Bucks. This is getting out of hand. Like, every single veteran is just going to go there with this Dream Team 2.0?
No, it's not Dream Team 2.0, unless you say that, hey, it's going to be like the Eagles that year in 2011 when they tanked. Bucks are not making the playoffs.
Not making the playoffs?
They're too old.
Whoa!
And they're getting older. Bucks are not making the playoffs.
You're writing that
they
down.
Were the healthiest team in the league last year. They're going to be the oldest team in the league. The Bucks are not making the playoffs.
Not making the playoffs. I mean, seven teams make the playoffs.
Yeah, Bucks are not making the playoffs. This team is going to be broken down this year.
Who's going to get into the NFC South over them, though?
Yeah, that's a decent point. That's a decent question.
But the Saints, I mean, no Drew Brees. It's Taysom Hill.
Jameis, I believe in Jameis. Jameis going to make him famous.
Matt Ryan, I don't know what they're going to do with the Falcons. I really have legitimately no idea what they do with that number four pick. Interesting. All right, that is quite the take to open things up.
I don't care about Giovanni.
I don't
Bernard.
Either, but I hate
I don't
that
care about
he's
him
there.
At all.
I don't care about him at all except for that the Bucs signed him. That's legitimately it.
The front page.
Shout out Oregon State.
This is the calendar section because the Mariners game yesterday was postponed because of torrential downpours. So a little bit windy out here on the Eastern Seaboard. Rescheduled. They're going to have doubleheader today. 2 7-inning games. This, along with the putting the runner on second base to start extra innings, are part of the concessions that they've made. No fans like any of these rules, right? No fans like them. It's the players and the GMs and the managers that like them. It's the participants. How do we feel about baseball making decisions about formatting of games to please its workforce? I should love this, right? I should love this because it's catering to the employee, me being the pro-labor union dummy that I am. And yet I'm like, that's not what I want to see.
I want to see nine-inning baseball. Seven innings is an abomination, and this tiebreaker rule is terrible.
Excuse me, sir. It's going to ruin statistics forever.
Yeah, I don't care about the statistics. I care about the abomination of, like, baseball games are nine innings long. And you play until somebody wins. You don't put a runner on second with some sort of convoluted tiebreaker.
You don't want seven-inning games when the Mariners are playing five-hour games. And I exaggerate, but, you know, 3.5 hours plus.
No! No, I don't. Seven innings is an abomination. That's what Little League does.
Little League, I think, is six.
I think it's more of an abomination when baseball games trend towards four hours.
Oh, really?
When it's not a playoff game. When it's not a playoff game, yeah. When it's not a playoff game, I'm sorry, but all these relievers taking their sweet time to get the ball to home plate, ruining my day, ruining my weekend. Get to the point. Throw the ball, bro.
Also, in transactions, the Mariners have recalled right-handed pitcher Eric Swanson because lefty Anthony Misevich is on the injured list, but it sounds like it might be a COVID issue. So,
oh, no.
Could be a close contact. We're not sure how long Misevich is going to be unavailable, but for right now, Swanson's in the pen, not he. That's going to do it for Front Page News. Let's get the professor in here for our morning drive.
John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
It's a four-way battle, and there's only going to be three spots. Somebody has to go.
The first and final word on everything NFL from the professor, John Clayton.
They scored 30 points a game. They're the best running team in football.
It's John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
Professor, is it fair for me to be annoyed with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers out-recruiting the Seattle Seahawks for Giovanni Bernard?
No. I don't think it's fair. I mean, it's like that's the only player they've been able to sign in free agency. They had not signed anybody else. What they've been able to do is keep their own players. That's the only player they've been able to get. And, you know, it's like sometimes it's not a matter of where the teams are located. And you're Giovanni Bernard. He may not want to come to the West Coast. I mean, he goes to Tampa Bay. I mean, they've got Ronald Jones as a starter. They lose Leonard Floyd, but it wasn't like Bernard, you know, again, Seattle definitely was interested in, definitely wanted to sign, but it's like you're taking a minimum salary deal for the most part, and he decided maybe location or what the team was in Tampa Bay over them. But again, it's not like Tampa Bay's signed anybody else in free agency. They haven't.
John, what role do you think Seattle was looking at for Bernard? And does this, I guess it's a way of asking, does this say anything about their expectations for Rashad Penny?
No, it doesn't. I think it's a matter that, they know Penny's going to be back, but also they like having Carlos Hyde. So it's just having another backup running back. And, of course, he's really good catching the football. He's 29 years old. There was a lot of positive things about that. And again, we're talking about a minimum salary deal for the most part. So I think it doesn't say anything about what they think about Rashad Penny. It's just a matter of like, hey, last year they expected Penny to be back, and he wasn't totally, but in the end, they brought in Carlos Hyde. So basically it's kind of more of a replacement for Carlos Hyde than it is for saying anything negative about Penny.
Professor, not only are you a Hall of Famer, you are a Hall of Fame voter. And yesterday there was blood on the internet streets because Julian Edelman has divided our country. Is Julian Edelman a Hall of Famer, guy who does not really have the most statistics when it comes to what he did in the regular season?
No, he's not. No way. No. No way.
But did many things of significance during the postseason.
He's never made the Pro Bowl, has he?
He has not ever made the Pro Bowl.
Yeah, so no, he's not a Hall of Famer. He's in the Hall of Good. He's not in the Hall of Fame. And, you know, when you look at his career, yeah, he's been great in the playoffs. He's done so many things. He's got three Super Bowl rings, all those different positive things. But it's like, I mean, if you're not good enough to get the votes of the players, the general managers, and the coaches in the NFL to even go to one Pro Bowl, do you get into the Pro Football Hall of Fame? It would be an abomination to think that he could do that.
Mitchell Trubisky did get
professor.
Into a Pro Bowl, though.
Take that, Paul.
I'm just saying, listen, the Pro Bowl, I don't put that much stock into it when Mitchell Trubisky's making it. But that's an abomination.
Yeah, when Mitchell Trubisky makes it one time more than Julian Edelman, what does that say about Julian Edelman?
That it's an abomination. I thought this was America, Professor. And then the 30th alternate quarterback's making the Pro Bowl. It's ridiculous.
No way. He does not deserve to be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I mean, it's like there's no support for him because, again, it's like if you can't even get the vote of the players around the league to even make one Pro Bowl, I'm sure you've been great in the postseason. How much of that was Bill Belichick and how much of that was Tom Brady? And, you know, he certainly did a lot of positive things, but somebody in playoff games has to catch the football.
When you look at the Hall of Fame, Professor, and on a serious note, when you compare playoff accomplishments versus regular season accomplishments, how do you weigh those two against one another?
Well, again, because you know, there's numbers that are there that kind of dictate for wide receivers, but also, like for example, I remember the debate on Andre Reed, you know, from the Buffalo Bills. As great as he was, Pro Bowls that he went to, all the different things, but he was so great in the playoffs. I mean, he even excelled in the playoffs, but it took him like about 6-7 years to be able to make the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I mean, because you have so many good receivers, and so in the end, it's like you weigh it, but also then you bring it up. Like we brought it up many times about Andre Reed, and fortunately, he was eventually able to get in.
What have been the toughest arguments for receivers? Because, I mean, for years there was discussions about Art Monk. I know Lynn Swann is a player that's generated. What are the stiffest arguments that you guys have had at the wide receiver position on who gets in?
Yeah, I mean, some of the stiffest arguments is, okay, it's not like there's a minimum number of catches and yards that you need to make. It's also how you fit in with the team, how you do that. And also, you know, like in the case of Art Monk, and, you know, there were so many receivers around his time that were up. And that's why it takes some time, because then you're sorting through a whole bunch. And then what happens when you have 3, 4, 5 guys that are all competing at one position, it takes votes away from each other. So it takes some time. We watched that recently with the offensive line, you know, whether it was Steve Hutchinson, Kevin Mawai, all the guys that were there on the offensive line. But a lot of times, because again, you know, wide receivers, you know, they're going to have numbers, they're going to have great reputations, they're going to be on good teams. But when you have a whole bunch coming up at one time and going against each other, they take votes away from each other.
Who are the next few receivers that you think will get in?
Eventually, I think Calvin Johnson will get in because you know he's Megatron, all that stuff. I mean, I think he did quit a little bit too early, but shortening his career because he retired like 30 years old or something like that. So he should get in. But I mean, there's always going to be a steady flow of wide receivers that are going to be available and try to get into the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
You guys, as voters, this becomes a challenge too, because you're going to see the number of receiving totals are going to spike here with the players, like the number of catches that guys have, even the yards that you have, same with passing. And then in running backs, I mean, 10,000 yards used to be kind of a magic consideration marker, and that's probably going to change because you're not going to have guys with the same career rushing totals. It's going to be hard because you have to kind of change with the statistical flow of the times and understand that guys are going to have fewer rushing yards and more receiving yards, but you still have the same sort of criteria of greatness to consider on who gets in.
Yeah, but it's going to be interesting now starting this year with the 17 games. You know, some of those numbers are going to go up a little bit, but no question about it. You know, once we hit that period, you know, in the, I guess you can probably call it the mid-2000s, where guys weren't getting the 20-plus carries a game, the 320 carries a year. I mean, you can see the numbers coming down. That's why, for example, in the case of Marshawn Lynch, I mean, he's a borderline Hall of Famer. He was able to get over the 10,000 yards, but is he going to get in? I mean, good chance that it's going to take some time to be able to do that. But that's the one thing we know in the Hall of Fame. We're always playing catch-up because, again, you know, you always have a backlog of guys who didn't get in the previous year or haven't got in for the last several years. And so we're always playing catch-up. And, of course, then you have a year like this past year where you have a whole bunch of first ballot guys to get in. It just holds things back. We can only get 5 in each year of the modern-day players.
Professor, we always appreciate your perspective. We're indebted to your historical expertise. We'll look forward to talking to you tomorrow.
Okay, sounds good.
That is the Professor John Clayton. You can follow his work on 710 Sports. You can also hear him this afternoon with Wyman and Bob. We're a little tough on you there, Paul. I feel a little bad about it. No, I don't. I don't feel bad at all.
Yeah, I know you don't.
No, in fact, we're gonna wail on you a little bit more coming up next.
Okay, better bring the big guns, bro.
Julian Edelman has retired. We're going to debate his place in NFL and Seattle history next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
A lot of people are trying to put up a shop to make Julian Edelman perhaps in the Hall of Fame or setting up another shop across the street saying, there's no way that Julian Edelman can be an NFL Hall of Famer. I'll be honest, even as someone who grew up a Patriots fan, I'm not putting Julian Edelman in the Hall of Fame. That said, I do feel like the guy should be respected on this day. As far as small wide receivers go, he's one of the best that we've seen over the past decade. As far as all-around football players go, I think he's one of the best that we have seen, period, in the NFL over the past decade. As a thrower, as a runner, as a returner, as a catcher. And look, while he's not going to be a Hall of Famer, the guy has had some of the most iconic plays in playoffs history, again, over the past decade.
And I guess that's the thing that I would say is, did Doug Baldwin get a moment of reverence and appreciation? I don't disagree with anything you just said, except for the idea that he's one of the best football players. Like, I think he was a good player. I think he's a really good player, and I think he played a very important role on a great team. But that's it. And what I guess the part where my hackles start to rise up is when there's a question of, is he in the Football Hall of Fame? Because I'm like, of course not. And then the second part is the idea that he was some sort of revolutionary football player. He was a good player on a great team, and he played a role for a team that, if anybody redefined slot position value or what that meant, it was his team. It's not Julian Edelman,
and specifically his predecessor Wes Welker, who right. also did that in Denver too. With Edelman, you have a guy though who was drafted as a quarterback out of Kent State, and after 4 years of not really doing a whole lot as a wide receiver, but being pretty capable as a returner, he blossomed into this role as a slot receiver. And the reason I say football player, Danny, is this guy also was a defensive back in key spots for the New England Patriots in certain situations. I feel if you want to look at him in the proper context today, he is about as symbolic as it gets of what Bill Belichick was trying to do there. That's not necessarily Hall of Fame worthy. He got the absolute most out of a guy that he drafted towards the back of the draft as a quarterback at legitimately every single position that he possibly could.
Sure. I've also thought that Bill Belichick likes to play jokes on the entire league by like saying, hey, I'm so far ahead of you that I'm going to play Troy Brown at DB consistently. I will do that for years. Like that sort of. So, yeah, fine. He was a great draft pick. Was he a better draft pick than Richard Sherman? Richard Sherman was taken in the fifth round. He was somebody that started.
But no one's
Richard
making that argument, though, right?
Right. But that's where this starts to go of like, I haven't sufficiently appreciated Edelman's greatness. Like, that's when there's the idea where I feel like there's a discussion about I need to properly. He's a good football player on a great team. And he's gotten to the end of the line, and he got released yesterday because he failed a physical and announced he's retiring. We'll see if he ends up coming out of the shed like Rob Gronkowski did and joining Tom in Tampa mm-hmm. Bay. But I feel like he's a good player is sufficient for paying my respects to him.
You got to say more than good.
No, he's good? A good player. He's a good player. He's a good player.
You have to, at the very least, say very good.
No, he was a good player. No, he's not. Statistically, he's not better than Doug Baldwin. Baldwin had more touchdown catches. Baldwin had about the same number of yards while playing in significantly fewer games.
Is Baldwin a good player?
Yeah, Baldwin's a good player. In the NFL scheme of things, if somebody said, hey, you know what? Doug Baldwin was a really good receiver. I was like, yeah, that's about right.
How much do the big time moments matter then? Because Edelman has one of the best catches in Super Bowl history against the Atlanta Falcons. Edelman had that ridiculous catch and run on a 3rd-and-14 where Cam Chancellor probably knocked him out in said Super Bowl. He caught the game-winning touchdown pass. He was the Super Bowl MVP of Super Bowl 49. And he also has one of the most important passes in Patriots history in the playoffs, a touchdown pass that he threw to Danny Amendola, which is...
Those are important highlights for Patriots fans. They're not important highlights for NFL fans.
Like, why not?
All of those things, because they're not the indelible moments. They're not like a beast quake. They're not like, honestly, like the helmet catch for David Tyree. They're really important plays for championship Patriot teams. Those are highlights that are really important for Patriot fans. I don't think they're really important for NFL fans. That's not something that's burned into my hard drive.
Well, I think anything that involves Brady is important for NFL fans, and they don't win that first Super Bowl against the Seahawks if not for Julian Edelman. In fact, they don't even get to that game.
Well, they don't win that Super Bowl even with Julian Edelman, if Jeremy Lane doesn't blow out his knee and suffer a compound fracture of his arm in the first half of that game.
Well, guess who caused that injury that might have helped the Patriots out? I mean, Julian Edelman did tackle Jeremy Lane on that play where Lane looked like he had a pretty big space for a return.
So this is about not properly acknowledging the greatness of Julian Edelman? Come on.
I am not necessarily going to say, oh,
that's
people
exactly
aren't giving him enough
doing.
Respect, but I would say right
That's what you just said.
You're not showing him much respect. You're not showing him much
yes,
respect.
Yes, I am. I'm saying that he's a good player.
Good.
I'm saying that he's a good player.
I feel like Baldwin was a very good player. I feel like Julian Edelman was a very good player. I feel like those guys are some of the most renowned receivers that should have gotten more renowned nationally, but locally were very well respected and appreciated for what they were able to do. And I think that some of the weird thing today that's coming out about Edelman retiring is there is a pushback to his career because there are some people that are saying, look, the stuff that he did in the playoffs was outstanding. And there's these people that are pointing out, oh, well, he had the PED suspension. Oh, well, honestly, he's not that good. And I think that's where it gets a little bit over the top. I mean, this guy's one of the better stories that we've had in the NFL over the past decade. You don't have to foist him into the Hall of Fame, but it feels like there has been a bit of disrespect towards the guy today.
Because you're manufacturing it right now. You've just brought up a series of things that I have not mentioned as some sort of straw man argument to prop up for saying that I brought up a PED. People are saying this. I'm not saying that. I don't care about that. I don't care about the PED argument. I could care less about that. But the idea that, hey, you have to acknowledge all of these defining moments that he had in Super Bowls, they're not defining moments to me. I've watched the NFL. They are for Patriot fans. And the attempt to sort of legislate league-wide or argue that there needs to be a league-wide genuflection at this moment on behalf of Julian Edelman and to concede that, oh, well, he's not a Hall of Famer, but he's very good. It feels like some sort of semantic crusade that you're on to have proper respect paid to someone who, quite honestly, he's a good player. And if somebody tells me that, okay, he's very good and Doug Baldwin's very good, fine. He's very good. Hang the extra very on it. But I don't feel like I'm somehow remiss in saying that I think it's ridiculous and obnoxious that there is a demand to show. He played in more playoff games than anybody. His playoff records come because he played in so many darn games, and that's due more to the coach and the quarterback he played for and with than it is him.
But you could also say the same thing about is not Doug Baldwin's success entirely because of Russell Wilson and specifically the end of that 2015 season, which is where Baldwin put up a majority of his touchdown
sure.
receptions?
If I missed the part when Doug Baldwin retired and there were a bunch of Seahawk fans that marched around the country claiming that he is one of the great postseason players and underrated guys who redefined the slot position, if I missed when that happened, I apologize.
And I've never said that.
If Doug Baldwin was somehow accorded this greater status than Julian Edelman is now being granted, I completely apologize because I missed when that happened. I completely missed when this similar brigade of what I'm now experiencing from Edelman people. If I missed that, I apologize because I think there are a lot of similarities between those two players.
Edelman in his career against Seattle, Danny. Pretty ridiculous numbers. I don't know if you've taken a look, but if you combine the Super Bowl with the two regular season games, this is just a weird anomaly, but 24 catches for 388 yards and a touchdown, and of course the Super Bowl MVP. Would you put him on any sort of Mount Rushmore of Seattle sports villains, given what happened in Super Bowl 49? I mean, he probably played through a concussion after that Cam Chancellor hit.
No, I don't think that he makes the top 10 of Seattle sports villains because Seattle typically has allowed larger receiving totals to dink and dunk receivers who don't have the ability to get over the top.
Oh, my God. What did you see in this game that he played against the Seahawks this past year where he was blowing by Jamal Adams like it wasn't a thing and he had a degenerative knee condition in that game?
Yeah, man, that was that definitely that defense was one of the all time best Seattle defenses. Like in week two, the fact that he was able to
just said
do
he
that,
can't get by anybody. He got by Jamal Adams.
You're propping up his performance in games against Seattle as being Seattle typically allows and has allowed over the terms they get let guys catch balls underneath. They're not that is his performance against Seattle completely redefined it. He carved up a bad defense in week two. And if you're going to say that is no, I'm not going to give him extra respect because he carved up one of the historically worst defenses we've seen, not just in Seattle, but of all time. Nope. No extra genuflection on that one.
He carved them up, too, when they were good, the Legion of Boom. But, you know, that's it is what
it is.
Because
they allowed dink and dunk and people to get underneath. That's not what they took away.
Probably shouldn't have allowed it in the Super Bowl, just saying. He does win the MVP in that one. He's Danny O'Neill, and Paul Gallant is Danny Gallant, 710 ESPN Seattle. Coming up next, you would think that you could say whatever you want to dump on a referee, an umpire. Think again. It might cost you. You'll understand why next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
There's a tendency these days to not call lies lies. Or to state something is, hey, somebody's talking completely out of their hind parts. We have no idea what they're doing. I love every bit about this story because it includes a sensitive umpire. It includes sports radio. And it includes a former player completely, completely weaving a tale out of whole cloth. Paul LaDuca, who people might remember, was a fairly accomplished, like he might even made an all-star game or two, baseball player. Someone had some time with both the Mets and the Dodgers. And in his post-playing career, he's done some talking, done some professional talking. Joe West is, how would you describe him? He's not quite, Angel Hernandez and C.B. Buckner are the umpires that are famous for being incompetent. Joe West is not incompetent. He's got a huge ego, though, right? How would you describe Joe West?
He is famous for being loud, if that makes sense. You constantly hear his take on things, and you definitely see it in action. He acts a lot more authoritatively than most umpires, and also the ego side of things. It feels like every now and then clouds perhaps his judgment or gets to a point where things feel more personal than they need to be.
Yeah. Also a country singer. He's an umpire that has a country music career. That should tell you a lot about his desire for the spotlight. Anyway, here's Paul LaDuca doing a radio interview. And we'll tell you about the legal implications this had, because those came to fruition yesterday. Here's Paul LaDuca talking about Joe West.
Hey, Joe's behind the plate. Set a couple more inches inside. I was like, are you kidding me? Joe hates me. He's like, no. Joe loves me. I go, he hasn't given us the corner all day. He's like, don't worry about it. He literally throws 10 pitches and strikes out three guys. Joe rings up all three guys. 8 out of the 9 pitches were at least 3 to 4 inches inside, not even close. Guys were throwing bats and everything. Joe walks off the field.
Now, he's talking about an appearance by Billy Wagner, very specific player, and that Wagner tells him that, hey, Joe West, set up outside. I'm going to throw. He throws 10 pitches. He strikes out the side. And then when they get into the clubhouse, LaDuca says, and here he explains, that Wagner explains why that happened.
We get back into the clubhouse, and I'm like, what the f*** just happened just right now? And Wagner just winks at me. I'm like, what's the secret? He's like, Joe loves antique cars, so every time he comes in town, I lend him my 57 Chevy so he can drive it around. So then he opens up the strike zone for me. I'm like, this guy's been throwing me out for the last 10 years of my life, and all I needed to do was rent him a 57 Chevy?
Didn't he throw you out of a game before the game started?
Yes. Sorry.
All right, well, there's only one Cowboy Joe, right?
It's a great story, right? How if you hear that in real time, how much do you believe it?
Well, I can buy into the idea of Billy Wagner giving him the 57 Chevy.
I can, too.
I can buy into the idea of someone being thrown out before a game actually started.
Yeah, I could see that happening, especially with Joe West.
If those two things are true, I'm probably not going to think too much further ahead. Like, those seem like rather specific stories that in some way, shape, or form have some truth attached to it.
Maybe he threw 15 pitches. Maybe he struck out 2 of the 3 guys. I'm definitely believing that the gist of that story is true. Joe West sued Paul LaDuca, and yesterday there was a judgment in that case, and he was awarded $500,000 plus interest. I think the interview happened 2 or 3 years ago. He was awarded $500,000 because that never happened. In this, because there's a narrow window of time in which Wagner and LaDuca would have been teammates, and that you could go back and look, okay, when did Joe West, was he on the umpiring crew? There was one game in this time frame in which Joe West was behind the plate. Billy Wagner did not pitch in that game.
It is impossible for this story to have occurred the way LaDuca said it. And he lost $500,000 because of it. And what I think is so hilarious is that, first of all, that the umpire is so sensitive. He's like, this might hurt the chance of me getting into the Hall of Fame. Like, that was part of his argument for damages. That was part of his argument for damages.
It's terrible that umpires can get in the Hall of Fame on a side.
And LaDuca's flat out lying. Like, that's scummy, isn't it? Even for an egotistical umpire. Like, it is. He did. He defamed an umpire who has an enormous ego. You would think you could say anything about because he's such a colossal, like, kind of pig-headed up.
Memory is faulty. Is it possible misremembering? And if he doesn't say Billy Wagner, is this something that can actually be proved to the point where Joe West is winning $500,000? I would think no.
Probably not. Probably not. And I don't know if they went to the extent of finding out, was there ever a game LaDuca was behind the plate in which Joe West was umpiring and there was a ninth inning in which three batters struck out on 10 pitches. I don't know. It did bring up this, and you had brought up this subject last week. The biggest lies in Seattle sports. Like, what Paul LaDuca said was he told a lie. He told a flat out big whopping fishtail lie. What are the biggest lies that have been told in Seattle sports?
Well, I feel like the first one has to involve the Seattle Supersonics, right?
Probably, yeah. When Clay Bennett stood up there in front of everybody and said, hey, we intend to keep the Sonics in Seattle, provided we identify a successor venue, I believe was the phrase that he used.
When he said those words, did everyone smell the poo? Did everyone smell the you-know-what in his voice?
I think people, yes. Everybody knew that there was another shoe. I think what Seattle's universal reaction at the point was we've just been sold into a hostage situation. Like, we now actually have the knife at our neck. I don't know if anybody actually believed that Howard Schultz would have moved the team. I don't know that people think that if Howard, who had been whining and crying and complaining about a new building or a new lease or new whatever for years, I don't think anybody thought he would. And this guy was, if he doesn't get an arena, he's definitely going to move the team. But I think everybody thought if we get an arena that the team will stay here.
It is pretty incredible in the history of Seattle sports how, whether it's Ken Behring with the Seahawks or the Mariners and their fight to get a new stadium, how those fights to get new stadiums were so dang bloody and to the point where they all almost moved.
Yep. Welcome to the West Coast, man. And now the result is you don't get publicly funded facilities for the most part on the West Coast at all. But you're right. They were bloody. Text in 710-710. Our text line is now sponsored by Mac and Jack's. We're really grateful to have them on board. A local brewer, has been one of the biggest draft brewers in the entire country. Mac and Jack's now sponsoring our text line. Text in what you think the biggest lies in the history of Seattle sports are. We'll go through those over the rest of the show. We got Brock Huer joining us next for Blue 42.